You're listening to a Left Lion podcast. Welcome to episode 9 of the Left Lion Interviews podcast. My name is Jared Wilson and I am the editor-in-chief and co-founder of Left Lion. Today's guest is someone I've interviewed before, but it was 15 years ago back in 2010. Jonathan Woodliffe is a veteran DJ who grew up in Burton Joyce in Notts. He became well known across Nottingham in the 1970s and 1980s as the first DJ at Rock City. Believe it or not, he even had a flat in Rock City in the early days, and he has some fun stories as a result. However, this interview focuses on his formative years at the place he first started DJing, the Palais. So I grew up in Nottingham and I was a teenager in the 1990s when the Palais was known as Ritzy. It wasn't really a place I considered going to back then. I was an Indian rock kid and Rock City was more my style. Ritzy just seemed like a meat market for trendy people. However, last year when DHP Family took over the Palais, after other rebranders Oceana and Prism, I felt quite jubilant about it. It's a really beautiful old building, and this month, April 2025, it celebrates its 100th birthday. Can you imagine a nightclub lasting 100 years? It's just really nice that it's going to be open to celebrate that, I think. I'm going to go in and have a proper dance there. So if you want to know more about the history of the Palais, then please grab a copy of the April 2025 issue of Left Lion magazine or check it out online. Not only is there a piece with Jonathan in there, but I've also done a deep dive into the history of the place with an article about what's happened there over that 100 years. Plus, there's a really beautiful cover illustration by Left Lion's Natalie Owen and a piece about how her grandparents first met there. I bet there are quite a few other people around Notts who might not even be born were it not for that place. Right, without further ado, here's an interview with Jonathan, aka DJ Jonathan, that we did over Zoom in early March 2025. From here on in, you'll hear a lot more of his voice than mine, but I was very happy to let him chat as it was all fascinating stuff.
Hi, this is Sophie from Left Lion, Nottingham's iconic culture magazine. Each month we publish a beautiful free magazine that shines a light on the art, music, food, literature and more that makes Nottingham such a vibrant and creative city to live in. It's a bit unusual for a local print magazine to exist these days, but we've managed to keep going for over 20 years, giving the city's artists, photographers and writers a platform to publish their work. We distribute 15,000 copies in over 300 venues across the county, and you can find Left Lion in every local library, every Castle Rock pub, in all active Nottingham leisure centres, and all the best bars, cafes and hangouts in Nottingham. If you're ever in town at the start of the month, you may have seen our Left Lion bike rolling around the streets. In line with our pledge to be a carbon neutral company, we deliver our magazines on foot, by electric bicycle, or where strictly necessary, by van. You can also read the full magazine and lots more for free at leftlion.co.uk. Check out the events listings on our website to find out what's going on in Notts, and if you'd like to promote your business or organisation with us, please visit leftlion.co.uk/advertise.
So firstly, Jonathan, where did you start out in DJing? How old were you when you first started playing records? What inspired you?
I suppose my journey started my introduction to music really was where the DJing came from. Because when I was at school, there was some friends of mine in a year above me at school that I got on quite well with, and they were already going to Northern Soul gigs. So at the age of 16/17, you try and get out and, you know, go to clubs, you know, which I did. I didn't really enjoy your normal nightclub night, should we say, at that particular time. The music didn't, you know, it didn't really, you know, inspire me. You know, I'd been down to the Palais on a Saturday night. Yes, I was underage. And, you know, they had like a band on, they'd have a DJ on in the main room. And, you know, they also had an in-house band that would play cover versions of big pop records, for the want of a better word. I seem to remember a name called Tristan Shandy, who if I've got that pronunciation right, they were a band at that time that were on a Saturday night. And, you know, at that time, you know what was in the charts. It was Mud and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I wasn't really into that music at all. But a couple of times on a Saturday night, I'd go downstairs to the Ballet High, and the DJ or DJs that played downstairs, if my memory serves me right, was John Black, who used to work at Selectadisc. And they would play a few Northern Soul records downstairs on a Saturday night. And the pally that you actually described in that your set of questions was very much like that. It was set in the South Pacific. It had this revolving dance floor. There was like, you know, there was two bars downstairs in the in this room that were sort of like built. The frontage of it had like, you know, bamboo cut in half along the front, and along the top there was like an awning that came over. And then the DJ console was on this back wall in front of this revolving dance floor. And it had sort of like a false rock with shells and stuff on. And, you know, the DJ was open to the elements, so to speak. So you'd step up off that dance floor onto the platform where, you know, you weren't working behind a DJ console. It was like almost you were open to the public, and the DJ console was on the right hand side, so you were at right angles to the audience, but you could turn around and talk to them. So, you know, that's how the layout was there. There was all wicker chairs and tables in the room. You know, it didn't look like any other club at all. And that revolving dance floor went round slowly. But it was quite a novel thing to have in a club. And, you know, John and the other guy, I can't for the life of me remember who was DJing. You know, they played some Northern Soul records, and there was a few people that I knew down there that were older than me. That, you know, if they weren't going out of town or to a Northern Soul night, you know, they'd be in there. So, you know, that was my sort of first introduction to sort of like going clubbing and going, right, pop music, no, not for me. But I quite like this, you know, these Northern Soul records. So within a couple of months, some of these friends that I knew at school said, look, we go down to the Brit on a Friday night at Trent Bridge. Why don't you come down with us one Friday night? So, of course, you know, very young Jonathan Woodley.
Is the Brit the boat club? Was that the Britannia
no,
boat club?
No, there were two. There were two separate clubs. The boat club and the Brit were two. It was the Britannia Rowing Club, and then there was a boat club. So there was two separate places. They were not too far apart, but if my memory serves me right, the other thing that was quite sort of like a challenge when you went to the Brit was the boat club had a rock night on a Friday night. So you had a lot of bikers outside. And of course, you know, people into Northern Soul going to the club two doors down almost. So there was always that potential of something happening, you know, and yeah. I've heard stories where people have been thrown in the river, you know, on the way down to this. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. But, you know, it was like, bloody hell, what am I letting myself in for here? So, you know, off I went down to the Brit one Friday night, and, you know, it was a baptism of fire. My eyes were opened, along with my ears, to an amazing club that was quite small, but packed with people who were into Northern Soul. And the DJ at that time, Denny, you know, had great records, you know, but it was a big learning curve for me because I knew very little, but I liked what I heard. And of course, my friends would be like, oh, well, that's so-and-so, you know, that's that record. So straight away, I was discovering records that I didn't know but liked. And obviously, you know, you wanted to purchase them. So, you know, I started buying a few records. And, you know, I remember very vaguely going to Selectadisc when it was on Arkwright Street, and it must have been right at the end, just as they moved from Arkwright Street to Bridlesmith Gate. And I went to Arkwright Street. I may have bought some records. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. But I do remember going to Selectadisc on Bridlesmith Gate and buying records from in there, because it was downstairs was albums and then upstairs were singles. So the shop was split into, you know, almost two counters upstairs where one would be chart records and then the other side would be punk and Northern Soul records, really. So, you know, we'd go up there and buy records. So that was really where I started my love of Northern Soul music and purchasing records. And
can I just check one thing, Jonathan? Sorry, because you mentioned school. Just so you're born and bred in Nottingham, aren't you? And what school did you go to?
Sorry, which?
What area of Notts were you from?
I lived in Burton Joyce, well, on the borders of Burton Joyce and Gedling on Burton Road. So it was literally very close to Cartley Willows School. But I went to Gedling Comprehensive, you know, which was like literally next to the pit at Gedling on, you know, opposite on Arnold. Oh, Lane, was it? I think it was called, or Arnold Road. So, yeah, that's the school I went to. So it was people who I knew in Gedling, Gedling Village, that were, you know, into Northern Soul. So then I found out that there was, on a Monday night, they did, there was like, upstairs at the Palais was like kids' disco, but downstairs, you had to be over 18 to get into the Northern Soul night that was on a Monday night. So, you know, they took me down to this on a Monday night. And that was where I got to meet, you know, quite a few people that I didn't see at the Brit. People a little bit older than me would go down there on a Monday night. And, you know, that's where I first met Andy Lee, who's sadly no longer with us. And Andy and I became really good friends. He was like probably two years older than me. He was at college and, you know, he was banging to the music, buying records. And, you know, He said to me, oh, look, you know, he got a car, or he borrowed his dad's car and would go to Northern Soul all-nighters and all-dayers out of Nottingham. So, you know, on occasions, you know, he would be like, I'm going here. Do you want to come? And I'd be like, yes. So off we went in his car to, you know, Cleethorpes all-nighters at the pier. I think we'd done maybe a couple of trips to Wigan. And, you know, it was every weekend I wanted to go out. It wasn't a case of like, oh, I was just happy with going on a Monday night. It was trying to go out most weekends. And I remember one Friday night going down to the Brit and then getting a train from Nottingham train station, which was, you know, literally round the corner from the Brit, and going up to getting a train to Sheffield and going to the all-nighter at Samantha's, which was on Station Road at Sheffield, which was a, you know, a 5 minute walk from the train station up to Samantha's. Now, that club was above, I think, an ice skating rink, 2 rooms. A very good friend of mine who I still keep in touch with now, John Vincent, DJed in the main room and would have guest DJs, and then Ian Dewhurst, or Frank as he was called, would play in the back room with other DJs. And you know, I'd regularly, well, I say regularly, I would go up there every 2 or 3 weeks to the all-nighter there. So going back to the Pally on a Monday night, I would go down, you know, and Andy would take records down for the DJ to borrow to play, because the DJ had just got the bare minimum of Northern Soul records. And obviously, Andy and myself were going out and buying records. And unfortunately, it got to a situation where the DJ, I think he got some illness where he had to go into hospital. It may have been a kidney infection or something, and he wasn't, you know, he'd said to the then manager, or legendary manager, should I say, Mick Knight, that, you know, he couldn't DJ anymore on a Monday night. So, you know, Mick knew that Andy was taking records down and doing a half hour set, so that Andy was then given the full-time job of DJing on the Monday night. And you know, I'd be bringing records down on the Monday night. And Andy was at college at that time, so what he did, he got his student grant at the beginning of term, would spend it all on records, and then through the term time would sell the records off to live. Where for me, you know, I'd got a part-time job, and when I was still at school, and you know, I was earning money, so, and living at home, so I was able, all the money I earned, I was able to spend on records. So, you know, within a few months, you know, I was going down, I was buying more and more records, Andy was borrowing my records, and my friends basically said, "Why don't you play for half an hour? You know, Andy's borrowing your records and playing them. Why don't you go?" And I was like, "No, I'm not interested. It's not something I'd ever thought of doing and wanted to do." So, push come to shove, one Monday night, you know, after them pressuring me, I capitulated and went, "All right, I'll go up there and play some records." And boy, was it the most nerve-wracking thing I'd ever done in my life. I mean, I was a confident person around people anyway, but to go and have to stand in the Valley High in front of these people, and of course, at that time, there was no art of mixing. Records were introduced, you know, pop DJs, and, you know, would introduce records and go, "Well, this is going out to Sue on her 18th birthday," or, you know, all the requests that went with DJing at that particular time, where the Northern Soul thing, it was more like you were playing records, but you would introduce those records because some of them would be known, others wouldn't be known, or somebody would say, come up and say, "Well, will you play, you know, Ernest Moseley, Stubborn Heart?" You know, and you'd play that record and say, "Oh, this goes out to so and so," and then you'd play the record. So you'd got to use a microphone as well. And that was just like, it was a real baptism of fire for me. I mean, I came off, I was literally shaking, you know, sweating. It was, but the adrenaline had kicked in, and I was like, "I can do this. I know I can. I can," you know, I was sort of like, I'd got the bug after doing it for, you know, half an hour or so. And, you know, from that Monday night onwards, Andy would, you know, let me play for, you know, half an hour or an hour, and you know, we had some great times down there. And then
So what year was this? Sorry, what that first DJ gig?
this would be sort of like, I guess, late 76, early 77. So, you know, we were doing Monday nights. Monday night was reasonably busy downstairs. And something had happened where I think Andy had sort of announced something that was on, an all-dayer that wasn't at the Palais but was somewhere else. And Mick Knight had heard him announce this and obviously, you know, wasn't very happy. And it ended up where Andy lost the job of DJing downstairs on a Monday night. And it left me in a bit of a position where it was like, well, do I not do it anymore? Or, you know, I got offered the job of DJing downstairs. And I think somewhere in a box, somewhere in this house, there's my first pay slip from the Palais on a Monday night where I'm still under 18. You're playing downstairs in a room where you've got to be over 18 and getting, I think, £5 for DJing or something like that, which was, you know, I was like, oh, this is all right, whatever it was, I can't remember. So I was then doing that all night. And, you know, I did so for, I don't know, you know, hard to say. It was probably 2 or 3 years, maybe, where I kept doing Monday nights, you know, and we had busy Mondays, we had not so busy Mondays, but, you know, there was always a loyal group of people that would come down on a Monday night, you know, slightly younger people who couldn't, who were sort of like, I was then over 18, these were under 18, managed to get in the room. Parents probably wouldn't let them go to all-nighters, but, you know, they said to, well, I'm going down to the kids' disco at the Palais. The parents would go, yeah, yeah, of course you can go there on a Monday night and catch the last bus home sort of thing. Because it didn't stay open. It was like 7 till 10 or something like that, 7 till 11. It certainly wasn't till midnight on a Monday night. And, you know, we had some brilliant times down there. And that's where I also started. I could see that obviously people wanted to go to all-dayers and all-nighters. So I started organising coach trips. So on a Monday night, you know, I'd be down there at the Palais. I'd go, right, you know, this weekend I've got a coach that's going up to, you know, Wigan Casino on Saturday night. If you want to come, you know, put your name down, pay me a deposit, you know, and we're meeting at the salutation inn on Maid Marian Way, because that's where I always had all the coaches when I do these, would always pick up from the salutation inn, because it was like a little lay-by there. It was handy because of everybody's got buses and they ended up going into Slab Square. So they could get from the bus to up to the salutation inn, straight on the coach, and away we went. So that's what I was doing, you know, from sort of 76 till really 1980. So, yeah, that was where I cut my teeth DJing on a Monday night. You know, the rest of history.
Can you tell, you mentioned Mick Knight. Can you tell us about some of the other characters there that you met?
Well, Michael Knight was the manager, and, you know, sadly passed away earlier this year. You know, he'd been sort of like working at the Palais for many, many years. Up till his retirement, and must have started there when he was quite young and built his way up to general manager. There was other DJs that I knew down there. There was a guy that used to play upstairs on a Monday night, and his stage name was Johnny Seven, because a lot of the DJs at that time had their own stage names. They weren't the real names. And, you know, I was like, Well, just, I couldn't think of a name that would, a pseudonym. So it was, I always just played as Jonathan, and that was it. But nobody that springs to mind. I mean, there was Dorman there that I knew. There was a lot of people who used to come down
Was
on a
Colin
Monday.
Curtis there? Because he's in I see him on posters with you now, and you're often Jonathan Rock City, and he's Colin Curtis the Palais.
No, well, you see, Colin comes from Colin's a little bit older than me, and Colin started DJing late 60s. So that's a very big conversation to have. So when we were doing the old, like they had, like, say for instance, we move on to like the all dayers at the Palais now, for instance. So they started doing all dayers at the Palais. It would probably be 74, 75. It would be either East Midland or West Midland Soul Club would hire the Palais out off McKnight and put the Northern Soul All Dayer on. So Colin Curtis would be one of those guest DJs, because Colin was a big, and still is now, a big, highly respected DJ. And you would have a list of DJs that would play at the All Dayers. So, at that time, you'd probably have Hector from Derby would come over and play, because Hector used to work at Selectinisk at Bridlesmith Gate, and then he went over, he worked there and then lived in Derby, and then he worked at he then left Selectinisk and went and worked in Derby. Rob Smith, who
Rob's records.
everybody will know who Rob is. Rob Smith was working at Selectinisk at that time and was also DJing. So there was a list of DJs not only from Nottingham or East Midlands, but the bigger names from around the country would also be booked to do the all dayers at the Palace. So upstairs would be Northern Soul, and there was nothing on really downstairs. It was just a one room all dayer at that time. But obviously, as time went on and the development of music, the downstairs and Northern Soul was upstairs, and then they started putting on jazz funk in the Bally High. And time frame wise on this, I probably guess that they started doing jazz funk downstairs maybe 77, maybe 78. Somebody may well correct me with the times on this. So that was downstairs. Northern Soul was upstairs, and the all dayers were like once a month. But there was all dayers all over the country. So you'd have all dayers in Birmingham, you'd have them in Derby. So the format was all over the place. So there was different promoters that would go into Mecca clubs and hire them out. So for that company to have people going in and hiring the club on a Sunday and filling it with 600, 700, 800 people, 1,000 people was big business for the Mecca, because they wouldn't normally open on a Sunday, so it was another revenue stream. So they were quite keen to put to have these all dayers on, and obviously they would serve food, and yes, the bars would be open, but it'd be 2 till 11, something like that, on a Sunday, and there'd be coaches from here, there, and everywhere, and brilliant times. So
So,
that's where that whole all day thing started, and those two rooms where you've got Northern Soul upstairs and jazz funk downstairs. Over a period of time, there was a change afoot. And I suppose as the downstairs room in the Ballet High got busier and busier, you also saw the gradual decline of the number of people that were going to the Northern Soul all day, Northern Soul all day. So there came a time, it would probably be, I'm guessing here, maybe 79, 80, where the rooms then changed over, where the jazz funk thing was in the main room and it was Northern Soul downstairs. So you then had the situation. I mean, Colin kind of, it was always then and still is now a trailblazer when it comes to, you know, discovering new music and playing new music, whether it be old records that people didn't know, which was the whole idea of the ethos between about Northern Soul music, was it was underplayed, unknown records from America that sounded like that Motown sound, but weren't on Motown, that were on small labels, whether they were from Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, New Orleans, New York, Pittsburgh, you know, all these. There was a wealth of little labels in America that, you know, would press up a small run of records and didn't do anything over there. And years later, somebody go to the States, discover a record on a small label, bring it back, and then suddenly it was a record that was getting played everywhere, and there was a big demand for it. So Colin changed his tact. This would probably be about 70, 76, 77, where he was playing more newer releases than he was 60s records. So, you know, his club was the Mecca at Blackpool. So not the main room, but the Highland room upstairs at the Mecca. So him and Ian Levine were the spinners up there at that time, the two DJs that were pushing the boundaries of music further forward than anybody else, where they started to play, they moved away from those stomping 60s records that were played at, you know, Northern Soul events, and started playing some slightly newer records, newer releases, 70s records. There were still great records to dance to, but the production was different, the sound was different, but there were great soul records, fantastic lyrics, fantastic singers, and there was an amazing response. So when Colin, they pushed it as far as they could, and Colin then made a decision that he was going to leave, he was going to stop playing at Blackpool, and this whole jazz funk thing started to, you know, started to evolve. It was evolving, you know. Colin was there at the beginning, rather, really, at 70, 77, 76, 77. He was still up at the Mecca, but he was, you know, he was getting gigs elsewhere, as he was all the time, whether it be playing 60s Northern Soul records or 70s Northern Soul records. And then he moved, you know, he could see that there was these great records coming out of America. And, you know, this scene, this jazz funk scene developed through those records. And so that's what was played downstairs at the Palais. And then obviously over a period of time, and it wasn't very long, maybe a couple of years, that the room switched over, so that you'd got a lot of forward-thinking people that liked these new records that were getting played on the jazz funk scene, left the Northern scene and you know, sort of followed what Colin and other DJs at that time were playing, these new releases from America. So that scene developed, And obviously, as more people got into it, that's where the change of rooms happened, at the Pally, at the Old Ayers. I mean, going back to that revolving dance floor, that dance floor didn't always work at the Pally downstairs in the Bally High. But so there were some Old Ayers where it didn't work because you could switch it on or off on the DJ console. And I remember one Old Ayer, and it's really vivid. We were downstairs playing jazz funk in that downstairs room, and the revolving dance floor didn't work that day. And they put some pegs in to stop it from moving round. But we discovered if we took the pegs out, we could actually make it go round. So what we did is got a couple, there was like pillars round the dance floor, and there was a couple of pillars that were close to where the decks were. So I got a couple of the lads to, well, sorry, I'll rephrase that. I didn't get a couple of lads, a couple of lads decided that if they put their arms on the pillars and then run on the revolving dance floor, they could make it go round. And they could also make it go round faster than what it normally did when it gracefully went round quite slowly. So we had a situation there where, suddenly we could turn this into something absolutely ridiculous where, we've got a full dance floor on this revolving dance floor. And of course, then we'd get the lads to be running and it would be going round twice as fast as what it normally did. And, yes, a few people lost their footing and fell off, but there was no injuries. But, it was, that day was just everybody was there. It was just like, do you want to go faster? Yeah, okay, lads, on you get. That was it.
Excellent.
But yeah, fun times, fun times. I mean, there was another instance upstairs when we had the jazz funk all day as on. And we'd had people like Lonnie Liston Smith and his band had played upstairs. Roy Ayres had played live. Shack Attack did their very first gig at the Pally upstairs. And I think Level 42 were on that day as well as an act that had just started playing live. We'd had a lot of different acts and PAs on at the Old Ayers, but there was one Old Ayer where this changed the look of upstairs at the Pally beyond recognition, where I forget who was promoting it, but they put on Tiz Wos. Now, of course, if you're old enough and can remember how manic that show was on a Saturday morning, you could either watch Noel Edmonds' Swap Shop, I thought was pretty boring, or you could watch Tiz Wos, which was just mayhem. So we had Bob Carroll G's was there. I don't think Lenny Henry was. Chris Tarrant was. Bob Carroll G's, Spit the Dog, Chris Tarrant, the Phantom Flam Flicker. But we didn't have Sally James. So a lot of people are like, oh, I can't believe Sally James is not coming. But that day, the guy who normally did the record bar and did some merch for the Old Ayers, thought it'd be a good idea to bring Crazy String with him, in the can that you spray. So, of course, we'd got the Phantom Flam Flicker running round in this masked outfit with, plastic plates or paper plates with shaving foam on, flanning everybody. And, of course, we'd got people trying to wrestle this guy down to uncloak him to find out who he was, which nobody managed him because he was a pretty strong guy for his size. But of course, they started selling Crazy String. Well, from a conversation I had with him, he bought, I think, 2,000, it's either 1,000 or 2,000 tins of Crazy
Whoa.
String down to the Pally. So, as you can imagine, it's like neon colours. Well, this was everywhere, and I mean everywhere. 6 months later, the lighting rig was still covered in Crazy String. The carpet was just like bright neon colours. Mick Knight was absolutely going crazy because it obviously this had got to be cleaned up for the following week. And, you know, of course, it had stuck to everything and everywhere, but it was just one of the maddest all-dayers I'd ever been to. It was just turned into just like the craziest thing you've ever seen. It was just unbelievable. I mean, you know, there must be people out there, but there won't be many who took pictures because not everybody, but, you know, buying a camera wasn't, or taking a camera to either a Northern Soul all day or all night or a Jazz Funk all day or all night. It was very few and far between.
Yeah.
It wasn't like everybody had a mobile phone with them. You know, the pictures just aren't there. But for anybody who went that day, you know, it will be forever etched in their minds, you know, as to what happened. So, yeah. Anyway, we better move on with some of these questions, otherwise we're never going to get anywhere. So,
well, you've touched on the gigs, but I'm wondering if you, I mean, you know, obviously you were DJing, but did you go to any of these gigs? Were you part of it with like Slade, The Clash, Thin Lizzy, Status Quo?
I mean, I was aware of those events because the Pally was, Mick Knight was always, you know, if somebody approached him to put something on and it was on a night where the club was closed and he'd got an opportunity to hire the club out to put, you know, a band on. So a promoter, in essence, The Clash, Thin Lizzy, Status Quo, Hanoi Rocks, Slade. I can remember the Hanoi Rocks gig. I didn't go to it, but I remember that being on. As to whether Slade and The Clash played at the Pally, I don't know, because it wasn't, at that time, it wasn't music that I was into. I wouldn't have gone and seen bands like Thin Lizzy, Status Quo, Slade or The Clash. Nothing against them, but not my cup of tea. So, you know, if somebody said, oh, these performed, or somebody hired the Pally out in the late 70s, then and put these bands on, then I would have to go, yeah, if you say so, because I can't disprove it, nor can I prove it, if you know what I mean. So, you know, I didn't go to them. I
have
well
second sourced all
on.
Those.
So yeah, again, sorry.
I've second sourced them. So,
yeah.
For example, what I do know
probably,
about the
you're probably not
is...
wrong. Yeah. But no,
like
I can't shed any light on
it. The story's about Joe Strummer when he played there, but that's all good.
We know it's hard having to wait a whole month in between Left Line magazines. Heck, it's difficult enough getting through the week. Worry not, listener, we've answered the call. You can get a pithy, up-to-date digest of the best stuff going on in Nottingham each week direct to your inbox every Wednesday by signing up to the Left Line Weekly newsletter. Left Line Weekly contains our top recommendations of events, new content, exclusive competitions and more besides. So what are you waiting for? Visit leftline.co.uk/newsletter to sign up now.
Yeah.
When did you move to Rock City then? Was it about 81?
It would be the summer of 82, where I'm just trying to think back now because I used to work, my first residency where I worked in a club through the, you know, Monday to Saturday DJing, but not every night was open. I think we didn't open on a Tuesday and some Wednesdays we did. So I was a resident DJ down at Camelot's. Now, I got that job in, it would be probably September 1980. And I got off, you know, I went to the States in 1980 on a record buying trip in June of that year, came back, was still out DJing on Sundays at all days, but I needed a job. And I'd worked in Colony Records, which is now where Rob's Records is now, for that summer, and then got offered the residency down at Camelot Club on Bridlesmith Gate, and started down there. Yeah, it probably would be September 1980. And the Monday night down there was the busiest night by a country mile. And it had been for a while, unbeknown to me, was Monday night down there. It was only a small club that had two rooms. The second room was like formal dining with a small dance floor. It was a typical sort of like upmarket club at that time. And then the main room, which was probably double the size of this other room, had a small DJ console and a small dance floor and, you know, a slightly raised area running around it. It was a warren of holes and little bars. Great place for, you know, to create an atmosphere. So I started DJing down there and, you know, went down to see what it was like before I took it on board. And I thought, I can see this working. So, you know, on a Monday night, that was the busiest night. We had a lot of the Forest footballers coming in. So you'd, Robbo would be there. You'd see Peter Shilton quite regularly and other players from Forest in 1980, along with a lot of other people who went out on a Monday night, because going out on a Monday night was a thing in Nottingham at that time. And I just went in there and thought, right, I'm going to chance my arm here. I'm going to properly push the boundaries and play those records that I was playing at the Jazz Funk All Dayers, the things that I thought I could get away with, not the jazz aspect of it, but the funk and soul aspect of the Jazz Funk All Dayers, and play them on a Monday night in that club. And it went down an absolute storm. And unbeknown to me, Paul Mason used to come down on a Monday night, because at that time, Rock City wasn't open. Rock City was about to have this refit. So they'd got the alternative night, or the futurist night was on a Saturday night. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and some Thursdays, they'd have live bands on. But it was kind of in its infancy at that time. But they planned to have this massive refit. So, you know, Paul approached me, and this would be sort of, I need to check my dates on this, because something in mind tells me that I started there in 82. You may be right, I may be out by a year, it might have been 81. But Paul approached me about coming down and being the resident DJ. So you know, he took me to a warehouse in Nottingham where they'd install this sound system that they were going to put, that they'd built this sound system from scratch to go into the club. And he said, look, why don't you come down and listen to this sound system? Well, they switched this sound system on. I was like, if I could play with a system that good, you know, that was me, hook, line and sinker. I want to do this, you know. And then the club got kitted out, you know, and it, at the time, it was a game changer. It was a no-brainer for me to go and work there. It was just like, I have to do this. And, you know, it had to be done. So I got, you know, Paul said, will you come work as a resident, one of the resident DJs? I said, yeah. He said, well, what we're planning on doing is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we will have live bands on. Thursday night, we're going to do a student night. I thought, right, okay. Friday night, we want to do this electronic New York sort of cool dance night. Not you know, a jazz funk or funk and soul night, but, you know, something a little bit different. And then Saturday night was a futurist night stroke alternative night. So suddenly I became a DJ who just played one sort of music. I suddenly had to have a crash course on, you know, the other nights. I mean, when we opened the doors for the student night, I hadn't got a clue what was gonna what they were gonna ask for, you know. But it was a fast learning curve, and you know, I would go out through the week every day scouring record shops to make sure that I'd got all the right records for the student night, all the right records for the Friday night, and learn and buy all the relevant records for the alternative night on a Saturday night. So in essence, I was DJing all three of those nights, not on my own. The Friday I was on my own. The Thursday with the student night was on my own. But the Saturday, Paul had already got resident DJs there. There was two guys that had worked there. And I'd learnt the ropes from them. Then I took over on doing Saturday nights full time. So I had to wear three different hats musically, miles apart. So if the timeline's right, which I can always check and get back to you, I think I started there in September 82. I think one of the first gigs that I DJ'd in the week when they've got a live band on, because we'd have DJs on who played as doors open when the support up to when the support act went on, in between support act and main act, and then afterwards, I think was Kid Creole and the Coconuts, which was completely sold out, absolutely fantastic night, and I had the records to be able to play that night and have a good night. Another one of those early shows was Level 42, which obviously a few years earlier I'd worked with them at the Pally. So it was great to, you know, see Mark King and watch them play and DJ as well. I forget there was another band that week and I can't remember who it was. I think one of the Rock City, one of the first brochures they did, which I have somewhere in the record room, I'll have to dig it out, and it's got the exact dates of these, because when they've done these various brochures for Rock City, they've always missed things out. They've either missed bands that are played there, or they've not
thought... Support acts. Always support acts and all those things. They always miss it out. So we've got their gig dates, but you never find out the detail of it, and you find out these amazing support acts and others that were on there.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I remember one night when, you know, the Thompson Twins used to play there quite regularly. You know, they were always worth, you know, we'd always have sort of like 1,000, 1,500 people. Somewhere, well, no, I'd probably say between 800 and 1,200 people that go and see the Thompson Twins when they played. And I remember one tour, and it was probably the last time they played Rock City, and I'd have to check, but you know, tickets were just ticking over, and they'd announced what the support act was for the tour, which was, at the time when they announced it, I knew who they were, because I'd obviously made sure that I'd made contact with a lot of record companies, so I knew what was going on. I got a lot of records mailed out, and they announced that the support band were Tears for Fears. Well, of course, by the time that tour got to Rock City, it was the week that Tears for Fears had like a top five single. So for the first time that I can ever remember, you know, because normally people are just, if it was a midweek thing, people would turn up, Creatures of Habit had come in, they knew roughly what time the headline band would always go on, and they'd turn up half an hour before that, see the headline band, and then go home. But because it was Tears for Fears, there was a massive queue. We'd completely sold out of tickets. You know, there was a massive surge for tickets. And of course, on the night, the place was full way before Tears for Fears even went on stage, because everybody wanted to see them. And, you know, that was one of those nights where the support band really did sell the show.
So I've got one last question about the Palais, because I know I've got to let you go in a minute. Have you been back much since? Like, I'm right in thinking you played there in recent years, haven't you?
Since I left the Palais, well, it was a case of, like, I would go and do the all-dayers. So whoever was booking the all-dayers, I would go and play and they would pay me. I wasn't on the Palais books as such. But obviously did do some booking with Mick Knight for some of the Northern Soul all-nighters in the late 70s. When they were still doing all-dayers in 81 and 82, but as soon as I got to Rock City, I started doing the jazz funk all days at Rock City, so that put the demise of the Palais. But since then, in the last 25 years, there has been a few jazz funk and soul oldies all days or oldies nights on, where, you know, they booked Colin Curtis, myself, and other DJs to go down and do, you know, a reunion all day, so to speak. So yeah, there's been about four or five that I've done over that time period. Certainly nothing in the last probably 15 years. Because it, you know, upstairs was a big room, and unless you got a lot of people, it was a rattling room to play, you know, to play in. And, you know, various promoters had put things on, done them probably too many times in a year, and made it so that special reunion wasn't a special thing anymore. And it diluted it. And then people were like, well, I'm not going to that this one. I'll wait for the next one, kind of thing. Where if you did them and made them special and did them once a year, people would go, oh, I'm going to go to that. I went to the one last year. It was brilliant. Once you start doing them too frequently, they lose the appeal. And I think that's what happened. So there wasn't anything on. I did, somebody from George Aitken's group did contact me, I think, when they did that Northern Soul night down there, maybe about 6 or 7 months ago. Something was put up on Facebook. I saw the post. You know, I messaged them, saying, oh, I used to DJ down there, you know, love to come back and play, you know, and we had a conversation over the phone. Whoever the guy was that rang me hadn't really done his work, didn't know much about anything, but was more a case of like trying to get this gig sorted out. And however it went, I don't know. It didn't turn into a booking. Without going into great detail, you know, he made me an offer and I turned it down, as it wasn't what I was prepared to go and play for. So, you know, what happened to that gig, whether it was successful or not for the company, I don't know.
My last thing is, tell us about this massive festival you're organising in Durham. I've seen it. Okay. It looks impressive.
So, I used to go up to Hardwick Hall at Sedgefield on a Sunday night to a night call to the Manor Born. This is fast forward to house music, late 80s, well, sort of like early 90s. So John Adamson, the owner's son, John's now the owner of the company, used to put this Sunday night on. I used to come up from Nottingham. At that time, Graham Park was living in Nottingham and just started DJing. Alistair Whitehead lived in Nottingham and DJed. So there was a lot of DJs in Nottingham playing house music. And they would all get booked to go and play at the Manor Born. I would travel up with them. That's where I met John when I went up with Graham the first time Graham played. And I then got the opportunity to play in the back room there of that those nights. For many years, I played in the soul room in the back, and it was house in the main room. And fantastic nights up there, great crowd, you know, met a lot of people from the Northeast from going up there, kept in touch with them over the years. And then right out of the blue, John had rung me about doing a, you know, a Man of Bourne reunion. And, you know, and we just got talking over the phone. And I said, well, I said, look, as you know, that's where I met my wife. My wife used to work for John in the hotel as one of the duty managers. She left, moved down to Nottingham. We got married. We got married in Darlington. John actually came to the wedding reception. And we had this phone call. And I said, well, you know, we're going to relocate. I'm moving up to Darlington. You know, I'm currently looking for a job. And he went, I need to see you. I've got this idea. So I was like, all right. So the following Saturday, I was up in Darlington, met John at the hotel. John said, right, this is what I want to do in the grounds of Hardwick Hall Hotel. I want to put a festival on. So we started this. This year will be the 11th one. And that's over 13 years because we had a fallow year and a COVID year. This one's number 11. And it's going from strength to strength. Not an easy job. Putting something like that on. I absolutely love doing it. The festival itself is absolutely amazing, how we managed to shoehorn everything into the site and make it happen. You know, there's probably 80 different acts on this year over 7 different stages. And like you say, we've got, you know, Scissor Sisters, Pet Shop Boys and Ollie Murs headlining Friday, Saturday, Sunday, respectively, and then a whole host of other acts performing on stages, along with a massive list of DJs, with Kenny Dope coming over from New York. We've got Dan Shake on, Gaskin, Kitty and Moore, Melon Bomb. We've got brand new heavies performing as well. A whole host of people. We've just announced this year's lineup. Tickets are on sale now, and I'm getting into the very busy period of running the festival for John.
That sounds amazing. I've seen the lineup and it's incredible. Pet Shop Boys as well, just one of my favourite acts ever, basically.
Good.
Left Line Magazine is Nottingham's free printed culture guide. We aim to shine a light on the city and its culture, each month bringing you between 40 and 56 pages of independent local events and culture-based journalism. Every month we distribute between 10 and 15,000 copies for free in over 300 venues across the county. For example, you can find copies in every local library, every Castle Rock pub, in all active Nottingham leisure centres and in many other places besides. In line with our pledge to be a carbon neutral company, copies are delivered by our team on foot, by electric bike, or, if necessary, by vehicle. You can also read the full magazine online for free at leftline.co.uk/magazine. If you'd like to promote your business or organisation with us, please visit leftline.co.uk/advertise. And if you'd like to pitch us a story, please email editorial@leftline.co.uk.
So there you go. DJ Jonathan, everyone. If you want to know more about the history of the Palais, then grab a copy of the April 2025 issue of Left Lion or check it out online. Not only is there an interview with Jonathan in there, there's also Bongo's Bingo, and there's 100 years of history that I have personally written about the Palais and the amazing things that have happened there. There's also a really beautiful cover of that issue that was put together by Left Lion's Natalie Owen, who also edits this podcast, and a piece about her grandparents and how they first met there. Please give it a read. If you want to know more about what the Palais is doing to celebrate 100 years, you can check it out on thepalais.co.uk. Palais spelled P-A-L-A-I-S, if you were wondering. If you want to know more about the festival that Jonathan mentions at the end of the interview, check out hardwickfestival.co.uk. It takes place up north from the 15th to the 17th of August. So in terms of this podcast, I've got a few potential guests lined up, and it will probably be just me for now. My co-host Sophie is still with us and might do one occasionally as well, alongside her duties editing the magazine. My other co-host, Adam Pickering, has sadly left the Lion now, but we've still got mates, and he's working on a really exciting project to help resurrect Nottingham's long-lost People's Hall. Might be worth getting him on to talk about that at some point, eh? Thanks again for listening right to the end. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like it and share it on any platforms you can. We love you. Bye!